T-minus 28 and counting, guys.
Sure.
Let's start with... thank you. I'm going to switch the order a little bit because we have experts available for a bill, and they cannot stay very long. And so if the committee needs them, I want to be able to have them in the room if needed. So I am going to move to House Bill 3540. And we have that one.
Madam Co-Chair, House Bill 3540 refers for voter approval changes to the implementation of Measure 37. The measure was approved by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means on May 1, 2007 and adopted by the House on May 4, 2007. The bill required several technical adjustments and procedural clarifications that were considered by the Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Primary starting points for making a claim under House Bill 3540B is not altered by the Dash 31 amendments. Major changes to House Bill 3540B are to allow claims based on land use regulations made by Metro, eliminate the dual threshold of 10 and 25% for comparable or waiver relief, and replace it with provision to provide proportional relief. Expand the scope of Measure 37 going forward, including statutes and additional regulations that affect forest and farm practices. Expand existing authorization for local governments to implement or administer transfer development rights programs between jurisdictions so the counties can decide to purchase development rights available under this measure from a landowner in one county and move these rights to another county, and or revises the cutoff date for new retrospective claims from May 15, 2007 to sine die. Subcommittee recommends House Bill 3540B be amended and reported out, do pass as amended.
Senator, is there discussion? Representative Grodd.
Could we have the people come up to ask a question of?
Here, well, get Richard come on up.
Richard Whitman from DOJ.
Lane, you want to come on up also, Mr. Director Shetter?
Madam Chair, we went through all this yesterday morning in the sub. So
yes, we did.
I guess I'll direct my question at Lane first, if I can. Yesterday morning when I quizzed the panel as to the report and recommendations from Governor Attia and Governor Roberts, you had not seen the document. Have you had a chance to look at it since then?
Co-Chair, Representative Grodd, I have.
They have many recommendations in comparing what Representative Smith and I proposed in our work group versus the leadership position, were any of the former governor's recommendations used in constructing the new amendments.
I'll remind you just to identify yourself for the record, please.
For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, co-chairs, Representative Gerard. I have not had any personal conversations with the former governors on the formulation of House Bill 3540. I know that they have had conversations with the governor's office, and I would expect probably the co-chairs of the Fairness Committee. I do believe that their input has been was received in the course of drafting 3540 and the amendments you received that you have before you. I can't, as I sit here today, I can't identify particular amendments and tie them to particular recommendations, but I do know that they had been in communication with the governor's office and with the co-chairs of the Fairness Committee.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative?
You eliminate the threshold with these amendments, but you substituted a new formula for determining a claim based on those same thresholds of 25, 15, 10%, etc. Could Mr. Whitman explain
how you are going to award a claim of 25%, which is how I interpret the amendment.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard.
Mr. Whitman, could you identify yourself?
For the record, Richard Whitman from the Oregon Department of Justice.
We're new at this.
Thank you.
I know.
I haven't had my coffee yet. Representative Garrard, the formula for determining loss of value under House Bill 3540B hasn't changed at all in these amendments. What has changed is the threshold is removed, as you noted. And there's an amendment related to that, that the if the government elects to not apply land use regulations, that it do so to allow a use that has the same value as the loss in value that resulted from land use regulation. So that's the concept. So it's really, there's no change in the formula.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative?
So how do you award someone 25% of their claim?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Garrard, you don't. You award them 100% of their claim, but their claim may be for a loss of only one quarter of the value of the property.
Okay. I guess one more follow-up, Madam Chair.
One more, Representative.
One of the amendments requires certified and licensed appraisers. Appraisers are hard to find in Oregon. This is going to require an appraisal at the state level, the county level, and the local people are going to have to get an appraisal to establish, as part of the process, to establish a loss. In your opinion, will this not create a tremendous backlog for all of the entities involved on a Measure 37 claim?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Garrard, the B31 amendments change the provisions with regard to who can perform the appraisals if, and it's for a subset of claims where the claimants elect to try to demonstrate that they've suffered an actual loss in value that's equivalent to somewhere between the value of 4 and 10 home sites on the property. The recommendation from the head of the Oregon Appraisal Board was that that sort of appraisal be done by a certified appraiser, which is a higher level of training than a licensed appraiser who is the sort of appraiser who does an appraisal on your house if you want to refinance it. So I don't know how many certified appraisers there are. The processing provisions of House Bill 3540 build into the process time to allow that to occur. And the bill is also structured to the expectation, I think, of the authors, this is really a policy point under the bill, is that most claimants will seek relief under the so-called express provisions of the bill for 1 to 3 home sites where no appraisal is required at all.
Comment, Madam Chair?
Sure. Representative.
Once again, I just have to record my frustration at the process by which this bill has moved through 2 fairness committee meetings, a floor session in the House and the Senate, and this is the 4th Ways and Means Committee hearing on this bill. At no time have the people of Oregon had any opportunity to speak in regards to this bill, and at no time has any public testimony been invited. This bill was heard just yesterday morning in the Natural Resources Subcommittee. 24 hours later, here it is for the second time back in front of this committee. This bill is a freight train on its way to the ballot, while a time-honored process in this legislature lies shattered along the tracks. I will be voting no. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Just a question for Representative Garrard. In your subcommittee meeting, I count some roughly 100 more or less changes, additions or deletions in the bill. Was there any public process in those in that hearing?
Senator, what's it? The amendments constitute 11 pages with over 100 separate lines of additions and subtractions, and we were given the amendments approximately 2 to 3 minutes before the committee began. Those amendments were reportedly made available after 5 o'clock on Wednesday, and put online on email to members of the committee. But for most of the committee members, we had approximately 2 to 3 minutes to review an 11-page document on an issue that is as controversial and complex as Measure 37. Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Devlin.
Yes, just to clarify a couple of things for the record, Madam Co-Chair. First of all, in the original process in development of looking at the issues of Measure 37 and trying to come up with an alternative, I believe there was a period of extensive public testimony. In fact, I've heard numbers that are in the hundreds of people actually testifying. And I'm sure that the parties participating in this and crafting this were taking that testimony into consideration, both the co-chairs of the committee, Senator Prozanski and Representative McPherson. The other thing is, I did actually insist yesterday in subcommittee that Mr. Whitman actually go through every single portion of the amendments, basically amendment by amendment, so that the committee clearly had an opportunity to understand what was in the amendments. I'm far too familiar, having been a former Rules Committee Chair, with actually being handed 40 pages of documents that are still warm and being asked to vote in 5 minutes. So I tried to ensure that at least the committee knew what they were voting on, so I had Mr. Whitman go through every one of the amendments line by line.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Buncher.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. I really appreciate all the work that has been done by the co-chairs of the Fairness Committee and the committee members as well. This is a very complex subject, and due to the complexity of it and because of the many individual claims, it has been very difficult, I believe, to have clear communication as to exactly what this means at this juncture. And representing the constituents in my district who have articulated to me very clearly that at this juncture they just cannot support the bill, I will be voting no.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The convoluted process this bill has gone through is actually reassuring to me. It means a lot of people looked at it, a lot of people worked it, and I appreciate that. I'm a little concerned that these amendments that just came out are unknown to most of us. They appear to actually improve the bill. I'm going to be a yes today, but I reserve the right to review these amendments very carefully. And when it comes to the floor, I expect I will still be a yes vote, but I want a chance to look at these very carefully. I believe in the committee process, and I appreciate the work the committee did, but this is a lot of changes. I need some time to look at and digest it, but I will be a yes today. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Schrader.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Appreciate the discussion here. These amendments, just a couple of thoughts. One is that respectfully disagree a little bit with my good colleague from Klamath Falls on testimony. While these particular amendments didn't get a lot of discussion other than the committee yesterday, I think as you look at them, you'll see that they reflect a lot of the concerns raised by members here in this committee, members raised by hundreds and hundreds of citizens that did testify at length length over almost a two to three month period on this. So I've never seen such lengthy hearings except maybe when he's went on the road. So lots and lots of people testified, and I think it's a tribute to this body and to the progenitors of the clarification of Measure 37 that they're listening to the citizens. As a matter of fact, they're listening to the people that have been steadfastly against, you know, any fix whatsoever, trying to make things right. And I challenge people, who here wants to give Metro special status where they're not supposed to adhere to the same rules and regulations that everybody else is? That's taken care of in these amendments. Metro has to play by the same rules as everybody else. There was big concern over this, you're going to steal 10% a year of my property or 25%. We're taking that out. We're trying to help people get a fair shake here. That's what these amendments do. I want to see people vote against that. We actually have surviving spouses now qualify automatically as claimants as a result of these amendments. If you don't like surviving spouses, I urge you to vote against this this amendment. This clarifies the refiling. This makes it very clear that there's no extra refiling. That person has to do this, gone through a very arduous process. If you want people to have to go through a more arduous process, please vote against these amendments. This also reflects the opportunity for people to make some money on this. The transfer development rights had a lot of discussion in the work group. My good colleague from Klamath Falls thought this was an excellent provision, but we were disappointed did not make it. I was disappointed they did not make it into the original bill. This gives an opportunity to protect high-value land and make development in a concerted plan unit type of concept where it should be, on non-resource lands. So if you don't want to develop on the high bluff, above, you know, high-value farmland, please vote against these amendments. I mean, I see things here that are just absolutely great. If you want to have to come to Marion County and file your lawsuit if you disagree with this, please vote against these amendments, because these amendments allow you to file it back in your home district. So I don't see a whole lot in here that's really wrong. I think this is a huge plus to a very difficult bill, a very difficult decision, I think has been described here. We have taken into account one concern after another. So while I would certainly suggest some of you have legitimate concerns with the bill, I'm curious as to why you'd be against these amendments. So I urge adoption of these amendments, Madam Chair, and hopefully the bill.
Thank you.
Okay, let's call the roll, please. The motion is to amend the bill and... Senator?
Yes, recommends House Bill 3540B be amended and reported out, do pass as amended.
Call the roll, please.
Senator Westland?
Aye.
Senator Gordon?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Devlin?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
No.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Senator Berger?
No.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Carter?
No.
Co-Chair Schrader?
Yes.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Hannon?
No.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
No.
Representative Galizia?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nathanson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Nolan?
Yes.
Motion passed.
Motion carries. Thank you. We'll return to the regular order of agenda. Thank you, gentlemen, for helping us out. Bills reported out, budget bills reported out of committee. House Bill 5001. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 5001 is the budget bill for the Advocacy Commission. The office was established in 2005 to provide administrative support to the Commission on Asian Affairs, the Commission on Black Affairs, the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, and the Commission for Women. The commissions are charged in statute with working to establish economic, social, legal, political equality for their respective committees, communities. The General Government Subcommittee approved a general fund budget of $402,000 and two full-time equivalent positions to support office operations and other fund budget of $104,000 to allow the Commission to spend projected donation revenue. The subcommittee approved the agency's performance measures as a work in progress with the understanding that the Commission will return to the 2009 legislative session with outcome-based measures. The General Government Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5001 be reported out to pass.
Thank you, Representative. Is there discussion? Senator Gorbachev.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. I would like to acknowledge the presence of and the leadership of Rosalind Farrington, who's in the back of the room. Thank you, Rosalind.
Thank you.
She is the former executive director of the Commission for Women and will serve as administrator for the advocacy commissions. I thank her, and I want all of us to thank Rosalind for being willing to take on this assignment, and particularly at this time. Ms. Farrington possesses the skills and abilities, the capacity to lead, the quality of leadership that's necessary to move our state forward. We need more Rosalind Farringtons. The advocacy commissions are here to help us shape public policy that affects all Oregon, and particular populations in our state that have historically been underserved and underrepresented by their government. We have treated the commissions, collectively treated the commissions with such disrespect over the past several sessions. And we need to say that. We need to acknowledge that out loud. But I believe that we are turning that page of disrespect today. That is my hope. And that we in the future will see the commissions and appreciate the commission's advisory role, a role that can help legislators craft policies related to housing, economic and community development, healthcare, education, policies that will impact the lives of all Oregonians, and particularly Oregonians, many Oregonians who still do not feel they have a voice in their government. I continue to admire the vision and leadership of Governor Atiyah, who had the foresight to create the first commissions, the Indian Commission, the Commission on Black Affairs, the Commission for Women. The Asian Commission came later. Oregon is changing. It's changing as we sit here this morning. We need the voices and talents of all of our people. And so I hope that we will, as legislators, we will be more responsive and be more aggressive in seeking out the commissions and seeking their involvement in the legislative process, and also recognizing that they have an active statutory role. They are not, we should not continue to diminish their place in government, and the opportunity that we have today is to acknowledge that they have a historical role, and our action today is about lifting up that role, affirming it, its place in government. And again, I just want to acknowledge all of those who serve in a voluntary role on all of the commissions, and again acknowledge Rosalind for your willingness to take on a leadership role at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'd like to add to that, we're also going to hear Senate Bill 624 today that will move the location of the advocacy commissions. And so following on Senator Gordley's comments, I think we are beginning to turn the page. The advocacy commissions, if Senate Bill 624 passes, will move out of a huge department, a huge agency, to the Bureau of Labor and Industries that is involved in doing the kind of work that the advocacy commissions do. I would follow it by saying also I believe that instruction will come from this legislative session to begin a really systematic look at the role of women, minorities, and emerging businesses. We have pockets of that activity across five agencies. We spend $11 million doing it, and I still would agree with my colleague, Senator Gordley, to say that there are people that feel underrepresented and underserved. And so hopefully this interim, however we define interim, between either now and February, where we may check in, or now in 2009, I hope that we will be able to come forward with a substantive suite of bills that address these issues, because we certainly heard in testimony across two subcommittees that people continue, despite the money being spent and the pockets of activity embedded in agencies, you can't find the help in the phone book. You don't know where to turn. And so I hope that what Senator Gordley observed today about turning the page and starting a new legislative relationship between not just the commissions but the important policy work that may flow from the commissions starts today and will carry through to the 2009 session. And I also want to applaud Ms. Farrington. She and I had long discussions about this. I have talked to Senator Carter, Senator Gordley, and Senator Winters with respect to the move of the commissions to Boley, and I am completely convinced that with Ms. Farrington's leadership, we're going to develop a quality product for legislative consideration.
Excellent. The entire committee thanks you for taking this challenge on. Roslyn, it's great to have you back. Any further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion passes. House Bill 5019, Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 5019 is the budget bill for the Department of Education's Central Operations, Special Schools for the Deaf and Blind, Youth Corrections Education Program, Grant and Aid Support to Local Programs, and Debt Service on Education Lottery Bonds. The department is the lead implementation agency for the state constitutional mandate to, quote, provide by law for the establishment of a uniform and general system of common schools, unquote. The Education Subcommittee approved a budget of $1.529 billion total funds, including $293.7 million general fund, $56.4 million lottery funds, and 446.44 full-time equivalent positions. We also recommended $31 million in special purpose appropriations to the Emergency Board for the second year funding of the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program and second year funding of the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, Head Start. Approved funding for the department is an increase of 5.9% total funds from the 05-07 legislatively approved budget. With the special purpose appropriations, the general fund budget is a 28.8% increase over the 05-07 budget. For the agency's operations, the subcommittee approved policy option packages to fund Phase 3 of the Pre-Kindergarten through 12 Integrated Data System, or KIDS, project, which is a growth model for assessing academic achievement at the student school and district level, continued funding for the Oregon Virtual School District, a technical adjustment for the phase-out of the Workforce 2005 Task Force, and a study on career and technical education. The subcommittee removed funding for the youth in the Youth Corrections Education Program that are 21 and over, or those that have already have diplomas from the State School Fund formula. Instead, a transfer from the State School Fund will fund these youth for 07-09. For the grant and aid program, the subcommittee approved $39 million in general fund for the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, Head Start. With current estimates, the program will now fund 75% of those eligible. The essential budget level for the program would have funded 57% of all those eligible. Also approved for the grant aid were $5 million general fund for teacher mentoring, funding for early intervention, early childhood special education program, an increase of $150,000 general fund for the Start Making a Reader Today Smart program, $50,000 general fund for the Chester Success program, and $50,000 general fund for a task force on civics education. Forecast revenue changes result in an increase of $36.7 million in funds available from the Common School Fund and several changes to the federal funds program. Budget notes were approved by the subcommittee to study alternative methods to funding transportation costs, direct the department to do further analysis on the viability of moving the Oregon School for the Blind campus to the Oregon School for the Deaf campus, and direct the department to report on programs and services available to students with autism and to perform a study on the funding mechanisms for the educational component of the long-term care and treatment programs. The key performance measures were approved by the subcommittee with direction to the agency to return to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee with complete targets for all of their measures as well as updated actual data. The agency is expected to identify the specific impact of all approved policy option packages on the updated key performance measures. The Education Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5019 be amended and be reported out due pass as amended.
Thank you. Any discussion? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Last session, the department stated that about two-thirds of their key performance measures were not applicable. This session, LFO states that more than half of their key performance measures have either no data, no targets, or neither. I think the committee's done some really good work here. So, Madam Co-Chair, I will not support a Department of Education budget until they meet the legislative requirements for developing and meeting performance standards, until they take our budgets, notes, and our oversight seriously. So I'll be a no vote.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Senator Bates.
I'm disappointed that we're not going to 100% of Head Start. I feel the most important thing we do for our K-12 system is the quality and preparedness of students entering that system. And the best way to spend that money, especially the extra money we put into K-12, would have been to put another $10 million into Head Start and have a 100% program. I will vote yes for this budget, but I realize this is a big step forward for Head Start. I'm very disappointed we did not fund it completely, and the money, I believe, was available in the School Improvement Fund. I can think of no way of improving K-12 education in the state more than getting a full Head Start program up and running. The 25% of the kids that might be left out are still going to be hitting our schools. That would be as well prepared as it could be. Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We have defined getting to 100% in this program as having 80% of eligible children covered. So that's what we're talking about in terms of 100%. We will actually have about 75% of children covered. It gives us a very short distance to have to travel in the next biennium to get to full coverage. I actually personally believe that we will find, once we get to 75, and once we make a little bit more outreach, that we will find that 80% is an exceedable figure. And that we will find that we probably will be able to get up into the, at least into the low 80s. But I think it's actually something that we've made a lot of progress on in this session, and we only have a few more steps to make to get to actual full coverage in this. And I think we'll be able to do that in the next biennium.
Thank you, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. I wish to be identified with the statements made by Senator Bates, but also add that funding Head Start is something that we could do in this session, and we should be doing it. The first commitment to fully fund a Head Start program, and remember, Head Start serves the poorest of the poor children. The first commitment was made in the 80s. At that time, and Senator Carter can verify this, a commitment was made that every Oregon child would receive the Head Start program. Now, that was over 25 years ago, colleagues. That was a promise and a commitment made to Oregon's children. And so I'm disappointed, frankly, that we cannot find the will to extend the budget to
take care of the need that serves the poorest or the poor children. I believe that we have the capacity to do that and to do it now, and we're still here, and so we'll just see how this all plays out. But again, we're talking about a promise that was made over 25 years ago, and we still can't seem to get to it. I don't understand that.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Galizia.
I appreciate the comments from the senators, and I think those on the committee would concur that making the investment in Head Start makes really good sense. I would remind everybody that the governor's recommended budget had a $29 million increase over the essential budget level, and the co-chairs came out with $39 million above that. And then subsequently we learned that as the federal poverty rate went up, it would have cost $51.5 million to reach the 80%, which constitutes fully funding. So some difficult choices were made, but I think everyone on the committee understands that this is a really significant investment in SMART, and although we're not quite where we would like to be, I think this is a fantastic start.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to bring the Public Safety Subcommittee's support towards increasing Head Start and thank the co-chairs for funding it at the level they did. We've been trying to broaden the debate about what public safety really is in our committee, and I wanted to thank the committee for working to focus on Head Start in one of our public hearings. So I'm pleased that we're moving forward with a significant increase in the budget on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Any objections? Senator Whitsitt. Motion carries. House Bill 5020, Department of Education, State School Fund. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 5020 is the budget bill for the State School Fund. The Education Subcommittee approved funding of $5.35 billion general fund, $634 million lottery funds, and $242,000 other funds, for a total of $5.9585 billion. Of that amount, $400,000 will be used for local option equalization grants. Due to an increase in local revenues, the essential budget level for the State School Fund has dropped by $17 million since the governor's recommended budget. The subcommittee approved a policy option package of $196 million general fund above the essential budget level. It also approved a fund shift of $100 million from general fund to lottery funds to accommodate the latest revenue forecast. When combined with local revenues, there will be $8.8 billion available for the state's school funding formula, or an increase of 11.6% increase over the 2005-2007 amount. That figure does not include funding available from the School Improvement Fund. The Education Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5020 be amended and reported out to pass as amended.
Thank you, Senator. Any discussion? Any objections?
Hallelujah, brother.
Motion carries.
That's only half the budget.
42% of the budget? Out the door. House Bill 5021. Department of Education School Improvement Fund. Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would note one of the co-chairs has a shirt with dollar signs on it. I don't know the significance. House Bill 5021 is the budget bill for the School Improvement Fund. The Education Subcommittee approved $260 million general fund for the School Improvement Fund, which provides grants for activities that are designed to increase student achievement. The School Improvement Fund was last funded in 2001 with $220 million. With later reductions in state revenues, the second year funding of $112 million was removed to help balance the budget. The School Improvement Fund was not funded in 03-05 or 05-07. A budget note was approved that requires school districts to identify the areas that they will target with their grant. It also requires a detailed description and quantifiable performance measures for the expected use of funds. The department will summarize the information and report back to the legislature. Education Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5021 be amended and reported out due pass as amended.
Thank you, Representative. Discussion. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be supporting this, but I do have reservations about the whole idea and concept of the school improvement fund, as mentioned in the subcommittee when we were discussing this. It would have been far my preference to have simply added this to the state school fund as such. We hire hopefully qualified administrators across the state, professional people with masters and doctorate degrees in the areas that they're dealing with, and it is, and I think should be, it's my position, and I think it should be our position that these folks, as professionals in their local communities, know very well what is best, and that this money should be distributed just equally across the board without having to go through this particular exercise that they're having to go through here, which is just one more exercise for them. I know that it causes some concern amongst the administrators who have known me in a past life to hear me make any sort of comments or accolades about the professionalism of that group, but that is fundamentally who they are, what they do, and I don't really see the benefit of our managing that particular profession in this particular way. However, having said that, I will be supporting the measure.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. Hallelujah. House Bill 5044, Student Assistance Commission, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 5044 is the budget bill for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. The commission administers state and privately funded scholarship programs, including the state's primary student aid program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The commission also houses the Office of Degree Authorization. The Opportunity Grants assist lower and middle income students who attend an Oregon four-year or community college. House Bill 5044 increases funding for the Opportunity Grant by more than 80% over the current biennium level and funds implementation of the shared responsibility model proposed under SB 334. The bill includes $43.7 million general fund above the essential budget level to implement the shared responsibility model in the second year of the biennium. The Shared Responsibility Model, or SRM, will expand college access for Oregonians by expanding both eligibility and award amounts in the Opportunity Grant Program. The cost of attending college will be shared by the student and the state, and award amounts will vary with the student's level of financial need. The bill will increase annual state support for the Opportunity Grant Program by 125% over current levels. The bill also provides general fund for the first time to support the Aspire Program. Aspire is a program that provides training for volunteers who mentor high school students through the college admission and financial aid application processes. The $700,000 general funds included in the bill for Aspire will allow OSAC to expand the program from 84 high schools to approximately 115 high schools. The bill also supports the transfer of the student child care program to OSAC from the Department of Human Services with the $900,000 in general fund. Funding in the bill will allow the Office of Degree Authorization to maintain current programs and will add staff to support the agency's private awards program. House Bill 5044 greatly enhances Oregon's efforts to expand college access. The Education Subcommittee recommends House Bill 54 be amended by the -1 amendments and reported out to pass as amended. And, Madam Chair, when it serves the proper time, I do have something that people have asked me to put on the record. So.
Thank you, Senator. Any other discussion?
Question.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. For Senator Devlin, I note that Package 105 was denied by the committee, the package that will provide administrative support for the Jobs Plus Scholarship Program changes proposed in House Bill 2246. What is the impact of that denial? What does that mean for the Jobs Plus Scholarship Program?
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair, that might be, I think Mr. Bender gave us a fairly good explanation. He's probably the best one to give it to us here today.
Mr. Bender?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The package that Senator Gordley is referring to is one that is in the governor's budget that relates to reform of the Jobs Plus program that would increase the transfer of funds from individual education accounts to Jobs Plus program recipients. Those funds currently, funds that are not used by the Jobs Plus program recipients, do accrue and are used for the opportunity grant if they are not used by Jobs Plus. The committee action has the effect of maintaining the current benefits for Jobs Plus program recipients, but because the reforms were anticipated to reduce support for the opportunity grant by $309,000 in the upcoming biennium, the committee did not approve that at this time in order to maintain support for the opportunity grant at the highest levels possible within the budget constraints.
And to follow up again,
Senator, yes.
And so what happens with the pool of Jobs Plus education funds? What happens to that account?
There is no change from current law, which is to say that these are accounts that participants in Jobs Plus program earn at a rate of $1 per hour that they are eligible in that program to meet education expenses for themselves or for dependents. And they are eligible to apply for those funds and will continue to be eligible to use those funds if they apply and if they have qualified education expenses for which they can be used as reimbursement. What will happen is that the funds under this proposal, the funds that are not so claimed by the Jobs Plus participants, will continue to be made available to help support the opportunity grant program.
Okay. Well, just to follow up, and thank you very much, Mr. Bender, for that explanation. In our Human Services Subcommittee on yesterday, as we were discussing a TANF proposal brought forward by Representative Kotek, we had some testimony about the Jobs Plus program as it's currently being operated, and some testimony from two TANF participants, one of whom has benefited from the Jobs Plus education program because he was informed about the program by his, I'm going to say, case manager. But then there was another TANF client sitting right next to him who'd never heard about the Jobs Plus program, had not received any information about the program. So we have this ongoing issue of how clients find out if they're eligible to apply for these funds. I continue to be concerned about that, and I continue to be concerned about how those funds get accessed. And I'm not yet satisfied that we have good responses, or responses that make it clear that all clients who are eligible are getting the information so that they can benefit from those dollars.
Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. There's one item I need to put on the record, and if Mr. Rocco and Mr. Bender would comment, that would be helpful. The child care program that's being transferred to OSAC is being transferred effective October 1st of this year, not July 1st. My understanding is, while we are funding this at about $900,000, there's still $130,000 that will be funded in the DHS budget that will actually make the program whole for the biennium. That's my current understanding.
That is correct.
Thank you for putting that on the record. Senator Witzel, did you have a comment?
Yes, and just a question, Madam Co-Chair. What are the projected roll-up costs for the shared responsibility model for the next two biennium?
Mr. Bender?
The cost of the shared responsibility model in the next biennium is projected to equal approximately $150 million in local and general and lottery funds. That is a comparison, that is compared, I should say, to a total that is being provided this biennium of general fund and lottery funds for the opportunity grant of the total funding of the program, let's see. Of about $105 million. So there will be an additional roll-up in that amount of approximately $45 million additional.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just to add my appreciation to the work that has been done on this budget, the shared responsibility model, I think, is something that we've been waiting for a long time, and the group that worked on that did a great job of quantifying the costs and the contributions and the potential revenue sources. And I very much appreciate that the this session will be the session where we'll fund this part of helping accessibility and affordability for students in community colleges and higher ed. And I think that this is a program that has a great potential to be successful. We did have discussions in the subcommittee around the problems in the biennium that we're in now with getting out the enhancement to the opportunity grants that were funded. There were significant amounts of that money were turned back because it simply wasn't used. And it appears that one of the contributing factors to that money not being used was that the financial aid folks at the campuses were simply not aware of the program, and the students weren't aware of the program. There wasn't enough people, there was not a critical mass built of people that knew how the program worked in order to tap into it. And we had a brief discussion in the subcommittee around how OSAC was going to look at educating the financial aid folks and the students about the availability and the dynamic of this new program. And it's with great interest, I think, that we should be watching how that program unfolds. And I'm hopeful that OSAC will be reporting during the interim and in the spring session about their progress on that front, because I think that it's very critical to this program being properly utilized and fully utilized that there is a very robust outreach to make people aware of it and how it works and how to become involved in it. But I do much appreciate this session that we will be enabling that program to take to go to a new level. I also very much appreciate the reinvestment in the child care funding for students. I think that that's going to make a significant difference in the lives of those children and those parents that participate in that program. Thank you, Representative. Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would, too, like to applaud the shared responsibility model that we have. I think this is perhaps, as far as this type of program, is a pretty significant improvement in what we have been doing. However, having said that, I have concern about the need for the amount of dollars that go into this program, and basically the reason for the need for that is because of the high cost of tuition that we have, which is in fact a consequence of underfunding our colleges or our universities in the state. It'd be an interesting study to know what we would have
to be spending for the shared responsibility model or the aid to students if those tuition fees were down more because of a more adequate funding type of thing. However, that is not the arena that we are playing in today, and as a consequence, I would like to applaud the, you know, what has been done here. And further, the child care issue, I think this is a significant, you know, step and an improvement. As a former instructor in an institution of post-secondary education in this state, I can't count on my hands and feet the number over the years, a number of young ladies who have come in and had to drop out of school for want of a $50 bill to be able to keep or take care of their child or children while they were you know, at the community college I was at when we were there, we tried to do something to help with these sort of things through a faculty association that would either give or loan money to them, but it appears far too frequently that the education of young people is cut short or eliminated because they are unable to provide for their children, and these young mothers you know, certainly are not going to let their children sacrifice in this way, even though in the long run they wind up probably sacrificing more. So the more we can do for child care for this particular group of people, the better I feel about it, and I applaud what we are doing here.
Thank you. Representative Trumbull.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Yeah.
Three things. Number one, I had to publicly apologize to Steve Bender and LFO because a couple weeks ago when Senator Devlin and I both thought that that I was going to be carrying a bill and were surprised when it was actually Senator Devlin. But, of course, we went back and listened. Well, I went back and listened, and Steve Bender once again was right. So I was wrong, you were right. Thank you again. I apologize publicly. Second, in terms of the shared responsibility model, my wise friend, Representative Jensen, I think makes a lot of important comments. I think we do. I see these as working together. The shared responsibility model, you know, access and affordability, and then this coming week, we have the opportunity to increase our investment in OUS and community college workforce development budget. So I'm sure we're going to be doing that. Also, the cost is there, but there's an opportunity cost of students not getting to college. And I think what the shared responsibility model is going to do is get students or young people who perhaps had not thought about college to indeed do so and make it more affordable. And third, I don't think there's been, just as in the 0507 session coming out, I don't think the legislature nor the governor got enough credit for increasing the opportunity grants. In the same way, I wanted to make sure that the governor's office and Senator Schrader and all those working on the shared responsibility model, I think, should get a lot of credit because this is an expansion of opportunity, and it's something that I think is extraordinarily significant for this state, and so I want to applaud their efforts.
Thank you. Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. Senate Bill 5542, OWEB. Senator Nelson, please. Yes,
thank you. Senate Bill 5542 is a budget bill for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, known as OWEB, and it was established by the legislature's agency designated to administer the lottery funds constitutionally dedicated to fund salmon and watershed restoration. As described by Ballot Measure 66 in 1998, Senate Bill 5542 also allocates lottery funds to other agencies to pay for activities eligible to be funded with Ballot Measure 66 lottery funds. The recommended budget supports OWEB's operational expenses with a total of $6.5 million in lottery funds, which includes funding for the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership and the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team. In addition, $5.4 million in Measure 66 lottery funds is provided for non-capital grants and $1.750 million in Measure 66 lottery funds is provided for support of watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts. Total support for watershed council district was increased to $5 million, including federal funds. The budget also includes $2.1 million other funds limitations and $21.9 million federal funds limitation. The federal funds are derived from the Federal Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Program. It includes $9 million in carry forward from 2005-2007. The budget also provides $5.7 million in the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery funds, federal funds for non-capital grants. Major 66 funding for capital expenditure projects is included in Senate Bill 5543, which we'll hear shortly, in order to provide the agency with a six-year expenditure limitation for these projects. The Natural Resource Subcommittee recommends 5542 be amended and reported out, do pass as amended.
Thank you, Senator. Discussion. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Looking at the performance measurements, I wonder if there might be some commentary with respect to the whether the monies that we are investing are returning the expected returns in terms of fish populations, restoration of habitat, and those critical factors that would tell us that these monies are achieving their intended purpose. I wonder if, because I'd like to make a correlation to an issue that's in our education budget as well.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you. There was a considerable discussion in the subcommittee about the performance measures, and if you'll notice, we did delete four of them. And there was I think they have the same issue as far as fish and wildlife is concerned, probably when that budget comes forward. And Director Byler indicated that he was willing to work with Paul Siebert at Legislative Fiscal to make these performance measures more meaningful. And I think you bring up a very good point. There was a lot of discussion about are these things really relevant and what are they really telling us? And I think we have a fair amount of work to do with that.
Thank you. And as a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Devlin, did you want to comment? I think Senator Nelson captured the discussion in committee. Yes. Senator Morris?
Just to point out a very minor issue in the scope of things and the amount of money that we're appropriating. The Oregon Natural Resource Institute has within its work schedule to do research on the OWEB outcomes to determine if, in fact, we're meeting our objectives. And the funding levels, there is a correlation, I think, between this budget and that budget within OUS with respect to appropriate funding to make sure that we do have some good, solid data and research with respect to these OWEB projects. So I raise that issue. It's a $50,000 issue, which Chair Galizio in our committee understands is a pretty small issue, but there is a connection here that could be very helpful. I raise that issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's very good to raise, Pete. Cross-pollinization here. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The performance measures, I think, have been an issue over the whole life of Measure 66. And I know when I was involved in that arena, we had a very exhaustive discussion because there also is now a very clear directive from the federal government, who also puts money into this arena, to have performance measures. And so the idea is to try to line the federal performance measures and the state performance measures up so that we aren't doing two sets of work that is kind of going the same direction but not quite getting there. I love the segue here because we've been having discussions in the education subcommittee about the budget for the Institute of Natural Resources in Oregon State University. And I think the discussion at this point is over $50,000 that's lacking in that budget, and part of what would be funded with that would be someone to start this process from the perspective of the INR gathering information and policy and looking around for likely ways to go in this direction. So I think that as we proceed with that discussion in the education subcommittee, that this should definitely be part of the discussion, because those performance measures are ultimately, I think, going to be a very strategic piece of the discussion when the measure is up for reauthorization and requires another vote of the people of the state of Oregon.
Good point. Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Devlin.
Just briefly, Madam Co-Chair. I think Senator Nelson did an excellent job, and there was an extensive discussion of performance measures in the committee and some actual modifications to them, and a clear direction to the agency to continue to work on them. And I want to emphasize one other item that wasn't mentioned here. Anybody that watches this particular budget, notice that this budget is almost like a clear indicator of where our lottery funds are going to. And this budget is considerably higher than it was 4 years ago. There is an enormous amount of money going through this budget right now. 7.5% equals a lot more in 07-09 than it equaled in 03-05. So I think the committee and this committee should be more focused on what is actually being accomplished here with the amount of dollars that's going into this.
Excellent points all. Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. Senate Bill 5543. Senator Nelson again.
Yes, Senate Bill 5543 provides the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board with a six-year limitation for capital expenditure projects funded by major 66 lottery funds. In 1999, the legislature adopted statutes defining uses of constitutionally mandated major 66 lottery funds for capital expenditure projects. At least 65% of the biannual revenue for Major 66 must be used for these types of projects. Many of the projects awarded funding by OWEB are multi-year efforts, and OWEB only makes final grant payments upon completion of the project. The legislature addressed this by treating the capital expenditure project portion of OWEB budget like capital construction projects, which have six-year limitations. Senate Bill 5543 provides OWEB with $59.5 million in lottery funds limitation for new Major 66 funds allocated in this biennium. The Natural Resource Committee recommends Senate Bill 5543 be amended and report out do pass as amended.
Thank you, Senator. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion carries. Thanks. Let's go to other bills reported out of subcommittee. House Bill 2193, Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 2193 increases various statutory fees associated with the licensing of radiological devices such as tanning or X-ray machines. Fee revenue is used to pay for the cost of inspecting these devices, and these fees were last updated in 1993, 14 years ago. Because inspection costs have risen over the years without concurrent fee increases, the program has been scaled back, resulting in a significant backlog of inspections. The department anticipates that this measure will produce $350,000 of new revenue. With this additional revenue, DHS will be able to hire two more inspectors and a part-time researcher to conduct statistical analysis of the inspection results. Currently, the Radiation Protection Services Unit within the Public Health Division has 21 FTE. The DHS co-chair's budget includes other funds expenditure limitation for this program enhancement. The fee increases are supported by the Radiation Advisory Committee. Created under ORS 453, this committee is comprised of eight experts on matters relating to radiological health and radiation protection. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends House Bill 2193 be reported out to pass.
Thank you, Senator. Any discussion? Representative Vienna.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Might I ask what the current fees are for those items that are listed?
Would staff like to come forward and talk about that?
Good morning, Mr. Britton.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Co-chair, Representative Hanna, all the fees are in the bill. The existing fees are in the bill, and the revision to those fees are in the bill.
Thank you. Follow-up question?
Follow-up.
The way this is written on page 1 of 2 in the very last paragraph, under this measure, canning device fees would increase by $24 annually. Does that mean it's going up $24, or does it mean the annual fee will increase by $24?
I'm sorry, Representative Hanna. Where are you on page?
I'm on page 1 of 2 of the summary.
Okay.
It's the very last paragraph. The way it's written, it looks like the annual fee would increase $24 annually.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Hanna, that's how I read it. I would say that it is an annual fee. So it would increase
$24
a year.
Each year.
Each year.
Forever. Or just once.
I'm sorry. In perpetuity. Once.
Are we sure about that? Because the way
I see DHS heads nodding in the back that it's just once.
Section 1, sub 2 of the bill, it says the registration shall include payment of an annual registration fee not to exceed $100. The current fee is $76. So the annual fee goes up by once by $24.
Which makes it $100.
Right. Good clarification, Representative.
Further discussion? Britain, don't leave town.
Representative, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay on that issue. Yes, thank you.
Okay. Further discussion? Any objections? Representative Morgan, Representative Hanna, and Senator Whitsitt. Motion carries. House Bill 22.
Before you go, I just want to,
Carter.
Please forgive me for after the fact, but I just want to remind our colleagues that we are seeing a great increase among our young people with skin cancer. And we are now having, and it's disproportionate to other places in the United States. And we had to do something in order to give the department opportunity to further investigate this machinery and so many of our young people getting cancer. So please know it's just not raising fees for the sake of raising fees. It's trying to protect so many of our young people who are faced with skin cancer in this state.
Thank you, Senator. That helps. House Bill 2278, Connect Oregon 2, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 2278 was referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means from the House Transportation Committee. The measure authorizes a second round of $100 million in lottery-backed bonds to continue the provision of grants and loans for air, marine, public transit, and rail transportation projects initiated by the 2005 legislature. The Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee amended the measure to require the recipients of funds from the Multimodal Transportation Fund to pay 2% of the recipient's total project's costs to fund a statewide multimodal study of the transportation system. The program will continue to be overseen by the Oregon Transportation Commission, who will work closely with the Department of Aviation, Economic and Community Development Department, and a variety of advisory boards and individuals in selecting projects for appropriate funding. The measure prohibits funding projects that could be financed by statewide highway fund money. The fiscal impact anticipates issuing bonds totaling $100 million plus bond issuance costs. Debt service in the 2007-09 biennium is estimated to be $4.5 million on 20-year tax-exempt bonds and $20 million in the 2009-11 biennium. These costs are included in the co-chair's budget plan and will be reflected in the Department of Transportation budget.
Thank you, Representative. Any discussion? Senator Berger.
Madam Co-Chair, I just would like to say that much good has been done by Connect Oregon 1, and much good will be done by Connect Oregon 2, and the committee requested also a breakdown of the regions, and it was very equally spread around our state, and our Department of Transportation has done a great job, and look forward to having Connect Oregon too.
Indeed, well said. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions that I think arose, and I if Representative Edwards spoke to this issue, I just didn't hear it. The question about the Multimodal Transportation Fund paying 2% of the recipient's total project costs. Mm-hmm. And I just need clarification on that, whether it's 2% of the grant amount or whether it's 2% of the total project cost, given that the grant, the Connect Oregon piece could be a very small segment of a very large project.
To answer the Senator's question, it is indeed 2% of the recipient's total project costs, which will be returned to ODOT to fund the study for multimodal transportation system.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Madam Chair, I do not recall a lot of conversation at the committee level with respect to this and whether or not, with respect certainly to the 2%, that was well vetted. But the question of the total project costs and whether or not that could potentially have a chilling effect on solicitations for Connect 2 funds, particularly in, I'm thinking, large rail projects, and whether or not this is an issue that needs further conversation in the legislature. I couldn't be more supportive of the concept, but Ms. Jordan can assist us in this discussion.
Thank you.
Ms. Jordan.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, the intent behind the 2% fee on the total project costs is to collect enough revenues to complete the multimodal transportation study. The recipients, a lot depends on how the recipients fill out their grant application form. It is my understanding from the Department of Transportation that all of the grant participants in the partners in each of the projects sign the grant agreement, and that each of them would be responsible for paying their share of that 2% of the total project cost. The only exception to that is that any project that has additional federal funds, the federal government doesn't sign that agreement. So it would depend on how the recipient or the grant applicant defines what their project cost is. Projects can be phased and be determined as the recipient total project cost. So the Department of Transportation needs to focus on the recipient's total project cost and define that so that those agencies or the recipients are, that we collect the right amount of money. There would also be my expectation that if once the study is completed, the Department of Transportation is going to be reporting to the legislature on the, not only the study, but what it cost. If there are revenues left over from that amount, the legislature would have to decide or could decide whether to return any monies that were collected in the fund to the recipients who pay that or to use that for further projects in the program.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up with one additional question. If I understand you correctly, Ms. Jordan, what you've said is, and I'm using a made-up example, there is a rail improvement project that costs $200 million. And an entity, let's say a port, makes application to fix a tunnel. Is the 2% assessed against the whole $200 million of the project, or is it just against the, can you phase it in such a way that it could apply just to the tunnel?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, first of all, there were no projects that cost $100 million that were
I would
exaggerate the amount of money that they would be collecting on the 2%, but it would depend on how the applicants put their project together. If they isolated the tunnel as the project and the cost for putting a tunnel together, in their grant application, then it would only be on the cost of the tunnel, not the entire project.
That's just now hit it, because there could be a $200 million rail improvement with just a tiny piece of it being a project defined under a Connect 2 grant, and it would only be that tiny project. You wouldn't sweep in the totality of a project.
I wouldn't. Correct.
Okay.
Further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. House Bill 2574, relating to mentoring. Senator Devlin, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2574A modifies the beginning teacher and administrator mentoring program starting with the 2008-2009 school year. The bill modifies qualifications for mentors and mentees, increases the maximum amount of annual grants and aid that a qualifying school district may receive from $3,000 to $5,000, and adjusts the maximum amount biennially based on the Consumer Price Index, specifies training for mentors, limits the Department of Education expenditures on evaluation of the programs to 2.5% of the total funding, and allows the department to use contributions for program evaluation, adds a measurement of teachers that leave the profession to the scope of the evaluation. Funding for the program was approved by the Education Subcommittee in the amount of $5 million. General Fund and House Bill 5019, the Department of Education budget bill, which you just approved earlier this morning. The Education Subcommittee recommends House Bill 2574A reported out to pass.
Thank you, Senator. Any discussion? Representative Morgan.
Madam Co-Chair, my thanks to the legislature this time for adding this program. I think that this is another program that has the potential to help with a significant problem, and that's the loss of teachers that are just beginning their careers. I'm very excited to see this go forward. I think that the outcome measurement on this is very straightforward and easy to achieve, and that it is, again, a program that has the potential to have a significant positive impact on the K-12 system.
Thank you. Good comment. Anybody else? Any objections? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Given that this is the last education-related item on today's calendar, I am compelled to thank the chair of the Education Subcommittee for his diligent work and deft political negotiations in developing the budgets we're able to vote on this morning. These budgets are very complicated and, as you might imagine, contentious, and the chair has done a wonderful job of soliciting concerns and addressing them in the context of the budgets.
Excellent point. I'll echo that.
I will second that if I had the opportunity, Madam Co-Chair.
Yeah, I'm going to retire now.
Oh, no. The bar has been set for next week. Any objections to this one? Seeing none, motion carries. House Bill 2967. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 2967, as amended, would refer to the voters of Oregon a healthy kids program and an increase in the state's tobacco tax to provide health insurance coverage for many of the state's estimated 117,000 uninsured children. In addition, the measure, if approved by voters, would raise the Oregon Health Plan income eligibility standard for pregnant women from 185% of the federal poverty level, where it is today, to 250% of federal poverty level. Children in households with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level would be eligible for the Children's Health Insurance Program. Between 200% of the federal poverty level and 250% of the federal poverty level, the plan would provide subsidies based on a sliding scale to families so they could purchase a Healthy Kids Plan commercial health insurance product for their children. Households with incomes above 250% would be allowed to purchase this product, but without any subsidy. If approved, the measure would provide an additional $7.1 million to the DPACO use reduction account account to expand our state's tobacco prevention and education programs during the 2007-09 biennium. It would add $2.1 million to enhance our rural communities' health care infrastructure, and it would strengthen Oregon's safety net clinics by allocating $5.6 million to a newly created Healthy Kids Safety Net Fund. Under the co-chair's budget, the Healthy Kids Program Fund would retain a 2007-09 ending balance of nearly $73 million that could be used to sustain this program despite modest declines in future tobacco tax revenue or increasing program costs from higher caseloads. The Legislative Fiscal Office estimates that the cost of referring the measure to voters during a special election would be about $1.7 million general fund. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends House Bill 2967 be amended and reported out do pass as amended.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome to our new guests. Is there any discussion? Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Senator Bates and I were just trying to choreograph our by now very overused responses to this bill. Having had this bill through the committee and on the floor, and I think that the remark that I made in the last subcommittee meeting was that this is really deja vu all over again. So let me be brief here. I think the main differences between this bill and the bill that was voted down on the floor are that pregnant women are added to the bill. In order to buy that addition, the top end level for eligibility for children comes down somewhat, and the bill is a referral. It still, I think, has the same issues attached to it. An outstanding concept for a program. I think it is a good public policy decision to put this program in place, but I think that the funding mechanism is fatally flawed. You have a program area, healthcare delivery, that has a double-digit inflation rate, so we can count on this program increasing in cost significantly over time, and it's funded by a revenue source that's guaranteed to decline with the amount of money that we're putting into tobacco use cessation and the general scheme of things in the state. I think that over time we will see this be a declining revenue source. It's destined to hit fiscal hard times, and I think that that's very unfair to the children and the families that will be ultimately enrolled in the program, and very unfair to the providers that are going to somehow have to gear up to deal with this somewhere around 117,000 children. The other issue here is that especially in the rural areas of the state, there's simply not enough providers to provide the services to these people. And for that reason, I will continue to be a no vote. And let me just pass this on to my good comrade on the other side.
Well, we'll get to Senator Bates, but we've got other people on this side.
Okay.
Representative Hannah, did I see your hand up?
Okay. Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. First off, I would like to compliment and commend the subcommittee for the amendment to the original bill to include the prenatal services. That was, as a number of you are aware, one of the key issues that I was concerned about, a key issue that I campaigned on, and I feel that this is in fact a major improvement in this bill. Having said this, I'm going to have to respectfully still be a no vote on this issue, and there are two basic reasons for this. I think it's the wrong tax. I think Representative Morgan has mentioned a couple of the items there with that, and I don't want to have to repeat those. But the other thing thing is, a reason for a no vote is, I personally am, if we're going to do these things, I prefer to do them straight up and do it in the building without a referral out. The citizens of the state obviously have a right on any bill we pass out, a constitutional right, to do an initiative on it, to repeal it, and I respect that, but I think it's our responsibility to pass the bills and not to pass the buck. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Representative Nolan. Since a good Representative Morgan has drawn her sword, I will now draw mine. And we've crossed swords on this issue, I think, three times now or four times, and maybe others, I'm sure, before we're through. First off, I'd like to make the point that all the children we're talking about here and the women who have become pregnant are all going to be treated in the state. There's not one that won't be treated. The question is, where and how will it be treated? Whether they're in rural Oregon or in urban Oregon, they're going to be treated. If it's a prenatal case, they may not have prenatal care and may end up having a premature delivery, which is incredibly expensive and dangerous both for the mother and the child. If they're a child who gets sick, they won't be seen in a primary care setting, which is much less expensive. They will wait until the illness gets much more severe and be treated in an emergency room, where the chances for increased illness and even death in some cases will be much higher. This bill is a step in the right direction. We must not think in a myopic sense. We must think of this in a broader sense, that this is the very type of initiative that will bring health care costs down. Getting women into prenatal care, getting children into primary care settings is the key to bringing down health care costs. We must not think of this as a short-term issue. This bill should go forward. There are other bills that will follow it to deal with the cost of health care in this state. If those bills are successful, in fact, this bill will not run out of money. It's part of a larger funding picture. It's part of a much larger picture of the problems of health care in this state. It's a great step forward, and one I wish we could all take together. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I misplaced my sword. I think I lost it on the first bill this morning. I certainly support the concept of healthy kids and what's in this bill. But like Representative Morgan, I will be voting no because I criticize the funding source.
Understood. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd like to quickly clarify some of the popular misconceptions about this measure. First of all, although it is true that it's likely to be a declining revenue source, in the near term, there will not be a substantial decline in revenue. Washington State is probably the perfect example because the proposed cigarette tax increase in this bill is equal to that of Washington State. After the first 9 months, after Washington State imposed their tobacco excise tax, not only did the state see increased revenues, it also actually sold more packs of cigarettes. Secondly, the number of smokers who either purchase fewer packs of cigarettes or stop smoking altogether is not proportional to the increase in the excise tax. That is, there's not a one-to-one relationship between the amount of money that's due to be lost due to cessation against the amount of money to be gained by the increase in the tax. And thirdly, the best estimates from our state agencies indicate that this program is sustainable for at least three more biennia. And I see this bill as a bridge to universal health care, and I think it's a way to ensure that we have the capacity and the infrastructure established to do that properly.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This will not be an exact repeat of yesterday's discussion, but since it's been mentioned that we've been through this, I wanted to add 2 points real quickly. One is to partially repeat something that's already been said. When we can improve health care for children and prenatal health care, we will see benefits right away in health of young people, but we will also then see the long-term benefits over the lifetime of those individuals who are born with better health care and receiving better health care in the early years. So we will see benefits from this in reduced costs and reduced need for treating certain kinds of chronic illnesses, for example. We will see those benefits right away. I also wanted to make a point about access to health care. There are actions that this legislature has taken already and has yet to take which can improve access to education for people who are entering health care occupations. We are taking steps. We've seen some today already, and there are still some left to do. And I'm very pleased that this body has recognized we do have a shortage in health care occupations, in those people providing health care at levels, whether it's nurses, nurse practitioners, nurse assistants, doctors, and other skilled professionals that are needed in supporting the health care of Oregon. And we are doing something about that as well. Thank you, Representative. Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just very briefly, I'd like to address what I think is the speciousness of the unsustainability of this revenue stream. When compared to our overall revenue stream that we fund these vital public services, K-12, higher ed, this is the most stable revenue stream in the building. This is the most predictable. When you have a state structure that literally is the most volatile revenue structure in America, a dedicated cigarette tax is the Rock of Gibraltar compared to what we fund the rest, you know, of this budget with. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, call the roll, please.
Did you get that? Senator Westland.
Aye.
Senator Gordon.
Aye.
Senator Johnson.
Aye.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Devlin.
Aye.
Senator Morton.
No.
Senator Nelson.
No.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator Whitsittle. Vice Chair Carter.
Yep.
Co-Chair Schrader.
Aye.
Representative Morton.
No.
Representative Hannah.
No.
Representative Jensen.
No.
Representative Garrard?
No.
Representative Galizia?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nathanson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Nolan?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Thank you. Senate's already on the floor, so we need to move quickly through the last two items. Senate Bill 328. Senator Gordley, please.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Senate Bill 232 passed by the 2005 Legislative Assembly required the Department of Human Services to study how to allow a child with developmental disability charged with a serious crime to assert a defense of guilty except for insanity because of mental defect. That work was conducted during the interim, and Senate Bill 328 allows this defense to be used by children with developmental disabilities. A successful affirmative defense would enable a juvenile court judge to order a child into the physical custody of a designated DHS facility for appropriate treatment and to place the child under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The subcommittee had a good discussion of the policy embodied in Senate Bill 328A. On balance, members believe that this measure has merit and should move forward. Still, committee members had both policy and budgetary concerns. For example, some subcommittee members questioned whether a possible PSRB decision to place a child in a locked facility to protect the public safety is an appropriate way to provide treatment. Also, from a budgetary standpoint, the federal government does not typically allow Medicaid funding to be used to support children in locked facilities. While the governor's and co-chair's budget includes $2 million of general fund in the DHS budget to care for 10 children who successfully use this defense,
That amount could prove to be insufficient if the PSRB assigns most of these children to locked facilities or more than 10 children successfully assert this defense. Given these concerns, the chair of the subcommittee asked staff to work with subcommittee members to draft a budget note that would be included in the DHS budget report to require both the department and PSRB to report on how the changes required by Senate Bill 328 are being implemented during the 2007-09 biennium. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 328 be reported out to pass.
Thank you, Senator. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. Senate Bill 624, relating to the Oregon Advocacy Commission's office. Senator Johnson, please.
Senate Bill 624 transfers the responsibility for providing administrative assistance to the Advocacy Commission's office from the Department of Administrative Services to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It also establishes a board consisting of the chairpersons of the commission served by the Advocacy Commission office and the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to establish the qualifications for and to appoint the Advocacy Commission Office Administrator. It allows the Advocacy Commission Office to contract with BOLI for administrative assistance and rescinds the Advocacy Commission's Administrator's authority to adopt rules. Initial estimates by BOLI indicate the need for a part-time position to accommodate the increased workload associated with providing accounting, budget, personnel, and payroll services to the Advocacy Commission Office. Once the service level has been negotiated between the two agencies and the actual workload is known, BOLI may return to the emergency board if a part-time position or additional other funds expenditure limitation is needed. The General Government Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 624 be reported out to pass.
Thank you, Senator. Discussion. Senator Gordley.
Yes, I'd like to establish on record, Madam Co-Chair, why the rulemaking authority was rescinded by the committee.
I'm going to ask the staff to come forward. We had a very thorough discussion of this in committee, and I think that Ms. Manthe can provide a very effective synopsis.
Good morning, Ms. Manthe.
Good morning.
To the floor, Deborah.
Representative Co-Chair Nolan and Senator Gordon, pardon me. The subcommittee did discuss that there was a lot of conversation about it, allowing to give voice back to the individual commission so that they would be more involved in the decision-making. There was also some conversation about whether rulemaking authority was needed for the office.
Let me just amplify if the staff comment. I think this really is the opportunity, instead of having DAS have the administrative rule writing authority, that this would then transfer it back. And just as Ms. Manthe characterized it, once the advocacy commissions were given voice again, rather than being subsumed inside a great big bureaucratic agency.
Senator Devlin? I'm sorry, Senator Gordley, did you have a follow-up?
Did you wish to amplify?
Just briefly. Madam Co-Chair, Senator Gordley, I think actually the inclusion of that provision probably in the bill several years ago, in the last biennium, of rulemaking authority was probably an error in the first place, to be honest, because rulemaking authority is generally when you actually are regulating something. And since we're not actually passing out statutes that are actually, none of our advisory commissions usually have rulemaking authority. And the question would be, what would the rulemaking authority be for? I mean, that's the basic question. If it was the State Parks Department, it might be rulemaking authority for how various facilities were being used. But what would the rulemaking authority of an advocacy commission be? That was the basic question, I think.
I just want to be clear, if we're talking about rescinding authority that the commissions had in those already had. Is the answer no?
No, I don't believe that the advocacy commissions have ever been involved in adopting rules in accordance with our normal process for adopting Oregon administrative rules.
Okay, I know we're in a hurry here. I just want to say that I want to establish this for the record, Madam Co-Chair, that these commissions should not be seen as having a subservient role in BOLI, the agency BOLI. These are advocacy commissions for the state, and not to be seen as an arm of or an adjunct to BOLI and its agenda. I just want to get that on the record and be very clear about their independence as commissions and the independent authority of the executive director or administrator of the commissions.
That's my bill.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say during the 80s, the Pearson versus Virginia issue nationally brought some prominence to the reason why we worked so hard on advocacy commissions. And it simply was to work with the state agencies to be able to make, to ensure that any of the issues around contracting out, that people in these advocacy commissions had the opportunity to work with larger groups of communities. I have to tell you that I'm taken aback and somewhat incensed by the fact that all the work of the 80s is seemingly going away and has everything to do with trying to correct discrimination in this state. Discrimination in terms of contracting. So if anything is being taken away from what this commission had prior to today, I'm going to definitely be a no. And I'm going to tell you how incensed I am at all the work that we did to try to find status in this state for contracting out and for other issues around civil rights. It's bothering me greatly. Thank you. Senator Devlin.
I just want to clarify for the record something that commonly seems to not be. The advocacy commission, each four, all four of them, remain independent. They are always independent. Even this is the Office of Advocacy Commissions, which is the support arm for the four advocacy commissions, which is actually providing support to them. That is still, in a sense, at the direction of the four advocacy commissions, because obviously in this group that's made up, they represent four out of the five people, the other being the Commissioner of Labor and Industries. They are always independent. No one has ever been talking about taking away their independence. This is the Office of Advocacy Commissions, which is actually simply the support arm, providing them with the services that they need to fulfill their missions.
It is interesting to note, however, Madam Chair, that the way that this is being structured, the BOLI commissioner would be on a body with the four commission chairs to select the administrator for the advocacy commissions. And frankly, I question that. I'm going to support the bill. I'm going to be real clear about that. But I do support anything that looks like a paternalistic relationship for these agencies. I just want to be real clear about that.
Madam Chair, I want to point out that the bill that we are amending actually gave that role totally to the administrator of DAS and did not give the role, that role at all to the advocacy commissions. So this is
I think it's very important that all of these points have been put on the record and that we really clearly establish that the commissions retain their autonomy and independence, that this bill moves the administrative support to an agency that I think will actually reinforce that independence better than the place that, that these commissions have been staffed in the past. Further discussion? Representative Jensen, 30 seconds.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know time is of the essence. And I wish to express my appreciation of the comments from both Senator Carter and Senator Gordley. And I wish to point out to them that this, the issues that they're bringing forth were seriously considered in the subcommittee and in relationship to the rulemaking authority. Not only did we staff talk to us about that, but we went to the staff of the Senate appropriate Senate committee and had and called them in to talk to us about this, as it appeared when they were discussing it in the Senate. And I had legislative counsel on the phone, or not on the phone, but monitoring with the instruction if there was any discrepancy or anything different, that they would come immediately to the committee to advise us of those things. So this was something that was seriously considered. We talked about it at some length and took considerable time with it. And I understand very much, Senators, where you're coming from. We understood it as a committee at the time. And in fact, Senator Johnson is about as passionate about the Advocacy Committee for Women and Women's Contracting as you all are for women, I know, too, as well as for folks of color. So we appreciate very much and your wisdom, and we appreciate your leadership that you have given us in the Oregon State Legislature over the years. And that was, at least as far as the chair was concerned, all being considered while this was being discussed.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam
Co-Chair.
Nice close, Representative. Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. Folks, we've done a lot of work today. We have a lot of work to do in the next week or so in subcommittees. I hope it is becoming obvious that the work in the subcommittees is shaping the way things come both to the full and out to the different floors. And there's room yet for more shaping of the final budget before we're done, and I appreciate all the work that all of you are doing in subcommittee.
Just a real brief, I would echo that. I'd also hope that people are aware we're going home soon, and that the budget bills themselves will probably be done within the next 2 weeks. So that's the timeline we're hoping to work under here so we can all get back home. Secondly, I would ask that all the senators go to the floor. Senator President is lacking a sufficient number of people to do a lot of business right now.
And the House is on the floor now, too, so we're due up there.
Budget bill we have, remember?
Thank you.